It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. As teens live more of their lives online, researchers wonder about the degree of online racial discrimination they encounter in these virtual spaces, and then what the ripple effect is on academic performance and the emotional well-being of adolescents of color. Call in at any point with your questions about youth exposure to racial harassment and discrimination, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alvin Thomas is a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies and the Phyllis Northway Faculty Fellow at the School of Human and Ecology at UW-Madison. Alvin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for welcoming me back and for inviting me to be with you this morning.
Well, let's start with your survey. You surveyed over 350 Black and Hispanic teens across America. What did you hear from your respondents?
So we heard a number of things. So we asked them about their physical health. We asked them about their psychological health, so mental health issues. We asked them about their social media use. And it's pretty interesting, a lot of it in keeping with what we already know about how Black and Hispanic teens and also white teens use social media. So very high levels of social media use across all teens, but significantly higher use for among Black and Hispanic teens. But we also did see some negative effects of social media use on both the mental health and academic health of Black and Hispanic teens. But we did surprisingly see a positive effect for social media use over to academic outcomes for youth. And we could talk a little bit about what that positive effect might have looked like.
Let's put a peg in that for just a moment. Did you feel like the teens were being honest with you about their responses?
I think generally, because it is anonymous, teens are more likely to report very accurately. We generally trust teens' report because it's, one, because it's anonymous, two, because they're doing it without the parent looking over their shoulders. We tell them exactly how to kind of protect their privacy around that information. There is, of course, some expectation, in small ways where teens might over-report or under-report because of one reason or another. But in general, I think the science generally appreciates and values teens' reports about their own activities and their own health.
How did you reach these teens? Where did you find them?
It's amazing. So there are a number of different platforms on which and services that allow you to be able to tap into teens who are currently using sites. Very often we have survey type resources that are able to tell you where these teens are and can advertise surveys to them and say, hey, here's a survey that is seeking to explore these particular issues. Are these issues that you're interested in? Are these issues that are meaningful to you? Would you like to take a survey? And here is a small reward if you decide to take that survey. And so that's where we found most of these teens, in those very spaces that they are occupying and are reporting that they're using.
When you look at the survey results, especially with social media, what differences did you see on the effects of gender and social media?
So we definitely saw a much larger... Let me step back a little bit.
Sure.
So we explored three different indices of social media use. We wanted to know how much time kids were spending on social media, the number of accounts they had on social media, and the kinds of activities that they said they were doing, whether they were showing up just to see what was going on, just browsing, whether they were clicking just like and unlike and or posting, what kinds of activities they were doing. And across those three, we saw significantly higher total social media use among Black and Hispanic teens. When we looked at gender differences, we saw that female adolescents had far more accounts than male adolescents. We saw a slightly higher In the number of activities or the range of activities that girls use, that girls engage in than boys, but it wasn't significant. But the biggest difference, I think, gender-wise, was the number of accounts, with girls having significantly more accounts than boys.
You must have wondered why that is. What might be going on?
We're trying to figure that out as well. We're not sure if it is that girls are a little bit more social, a little bit more widespread or dispersed in their networks, the kinds of individuals that they're interacting with, the places that their friends might be, the kinds of activities that they're involved in might require them to be on dispersed networks, while boys might be more centric, might be more centered on one or two activities or on one or two friend groups, versus girls who have maybe significantly more or larger social networks. We think that that could be one possibility, but again, we would have to go back in and ask some of these teens, who are they online with? What are they doing online? Kind of do a deeper
A deeper
dive, a deeper
dive.
dig into what's going on there.
We're talking about teens and social media use, the implications, the effects. Alvin Thomas is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Human Development and Family Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alvin, you did say that there were some positive impacts on social media use, but to step back, what does past research say about the effects of online racial discrimination, online harassment on kids and teens in these online spaces and in these virtual communities?
So we know that in physical spaces, experiences with discrimination can significantly impact both the mental health, the academic health, and just overall health for youth and for individuals who experience it. We wanted to try to understand whether or not in this increasingly virtual digital space that youth are exploring and are inhabiting, whether or not that risk existed in much the same way and operated in much the same way. So we were expecting to see some potential negative outcomes. And I think that's exactly what we found. We found that the increases in or the higher levels of online racial discrimination were related to higher levels of both depression and anxiety, whether it's related to other elements of mental health. We have not looked at that for these data yet. We would have to kind of look at additional data to see if we see those same relationships. But the prevailing literature does suggest that there is that same negative impact from online discrimination to a number of outcomes for youth in the virtual or digital space, much like or representative of what we would see in the physical space. What might be interesting is to compare those two and see whether or not the impact of online discrimination over and above discrimination in the physical space, whether that is significantly more impactful. That's something that we've not done yet.
And I wonder too, especially from the responses, how can you measure the amount and degree of the hatred they are experiencing online? Like, how do you measure that?
So, I think if we wanted to do that, we would have to do maybe focus groups or individual interviews. And in this case, we didn't do that. We were doing objective measures. So we were asking youth to tell us in the last, give them a specific period, in the last time period, how many times did these specific did you experience these specific activities? And we listed the 10 top discrimination type experiences, and kids would identify which ones they had experienced in that period of time. A previous study by another colleague found that, and that's among about 101 African American adolescents. Those adolescents reported about 5,606 experiences, and that's that averaged to about 5 daily experiences. Now, we would agree that just one experience is more than enough to rattle you for the day, to throw your day off. Imagine having going through not one, not two, not three, but 5 experiences average daily of these kinds of discriminatory, very irascible kinds of experiences. For our study, we had a similar average of experiences as well.
UW-Madison assistant professor in the School of Human Ecology, Alvin Thomas, studies the effects of online racial harassment on Black and Hispanic teens. Call in with your questions about online racism or other toxic content and encounters. Share what you want to know, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, clinical psychologist and UW-Madison assistant professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies. Alvin Thomas, he examines the frequency and impact of online racial discrimination or harassment, surveyed hundreds of Black and Hispanic teens. Latest findings are published in the Journal of Youth and Adolescence. Call in with your questions at any point about social media hate speech, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Alvin, you gave us a morsel, just a bit of a crumb earlier, that there were some positive implications of social media use. What did you find?
So we usually think of social media as this horrible space that we should try to keep adolescents from. And what we're finding is that social media is a socializing space. It's a space where teens inhabit and learn and interact with their peers, with the world, learn how the world functions. And so we can't keep them away from it. We have to pretty much help them understand and navigate that space. So we found that youth who had used social media more had higher perceptions or more positive beliefs about their abilities, their academic abilities. And we think what might be happening, we didn't explore this, we think what might be happening is that some of these youth are using social media as a way of subsidizing and supporting their learning, as a resource for ideas, a resource for exploring ideas, finding new ideas, learning new things. But it is when they have these negative experiences, these online harassment or online racial discrimination experiences, that what could be a positive space suddenly starts to take a negative turn in their development.
It can turn toxic very quickly, just
exactly,
with one act, one incident. Your paper also looks at something called critical consciousness, and I'm wondering if you can introduce us with that concept and explain why it's important to talk about this process in development.
So I think that was a teaser in the conversation article, but we did have a paper that came out recently, soon after this first one, that did look at the impact of online racial discrimination on critical consciousness. And so that might be a different conversation. But when we think of critical consciousness, we're talking about adolescents or individuals engaging in civic conversation or conversation around issues that relate to their daily lives, their daily social lives and interaction with their political systems, with their economic systems, with their societal institutions. And so whether that means the individual's belief in their ability to change or to impact those systems, those institutions, that would be critical agency. And whether it is that they actually go on to take some action, whether it be protest or writing to a senator, or creating groups where they can discuss these issues, that would be critical action. And so there is both critical action and critical agency develop throughout our lives. In some spaces, it's stronger, it's higher. So I think we probably saw a lot of critical action and critical agency for Black and Hispanic youth, especially around the George Floyd murder. Mm. We saw it a little bit during the pandemic, and we saw it across the board for all youth who were beginning to engage in protests, were engaging in demonstrations, engaging in conversations around the school shootings, around the pandemic, a number of issues where student voices rose in response to some kind of perceived social failure or social inadequacy.
Looking at the circle around these teens, these Black and Hispanic teens, how can parents and caregivers digest your survey results and help kids navigate these online spaces?
So I think it's ultimately that is the aim of my work and of this paper specifically. It's to provide some support for public policymakers, for teachers, for parents specifically, to try to figure out exactly how they may be able to protect and support kids. One of the easiest takeaways is know what your children are doing. In much the same way that you wouldn't just let your kid walk out the door and not know where they're going and who they're going to be with, in much the same way when we let our kids get on their phones or on their computers to get online, we need to know where they're going and what they're doing. So do some monitoring at the very basic level, do some monitoring, whether that be through some kind of device or some kind of program or algorithm that you set, like a kid lock or something like that, or talk to your child. Talk to your child about what safe internet use looks like. Talk to them about the pitfalls of improper internet use, and create space so that your child feels comfortable coming to tell you about their own experiences, both positive and negative experiences, and be willing to keep to be quiet and listen to what they're telling you, and then spend some time creating space and creating a narrative around what they're sharing with you and helping them navigate some of those troubling experiences, if that ever comes to that.
Keeping those communication lines open.
Exactly.
Alvin Thomas here, as we talk about the effects of online racism on teens of color. Alvin Thomas, a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Governor Tony Evers called 2023 the year of mental health in his State of the State address and proposed millions of dollars for school mental health services. How could state funding best support the mental health of Black and Hispanic teens?
So I think we might be a little bit behind the ball, and I don't think it's just a Wisconsin thing. I think it's a countrywide thing. We did not prepare ourselves adequately for what I still think is a looming mental health crisis down the line, coming off of the COVID crisis, the COVID pandemic, lockdowns and anxiety related to the death and protests related to the murder of George Floyd. I think part of what has to happen is we have to be willing to put the money behind some of these issues, to fund resources that allow students to be able to find support when they need it. Often there's a disparity between the sheer weight of activity and experiences and easy accessible resources. I think critical is easy and accessible resources, and that sometimes means resources within the community, not just in the school spaces, but going into the community and infusing those resources in there.
I wonder, Alvin Thomas, you know, your research is really centered on improving the lives of kids, of Black boys and Black fathers. Also, where do you take your research from here?
So we have a number of avenues that we're exploring. So we're going to continue looking at this social media issue, this social media space as a socialization space, as I said, and continue looking at what the risks look like. But even more important than the risk, I'm always interested in what are some of the things that parents, teachers, and others are already doing that is helping to build resilient kids, and how can we upscale some of these things that are already being done. And then how can we now also subsidize it with new skills, new coping mechanisms? So I'm going to continue exploring that. We recently released the Black Fatherhood podcast around Juneteenth and Father's Day of last year. And we're going to get ready to put together a second round or second season of that podcast to explore specifically the challenges for Black fatherhood, the experiences for Black fatherhood, but also the unspoken benefits for fatherhood in general, but in this case, fatherhood specifically. Mm. So looking at both of those spaces is going to be what's going to continue happening for this year and probably into next year as well.
Alvin, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Alvin Thomas, clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Human Development at UW-Madison. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.